Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for January 10th, 2019. Don't say 18, it's 2019. So I'll be doing a little bit of talk tonight, a discussion on the Russians are putting a radio telescope into space. Now, this is their second spatial outer space radio telescope. And it's twice as big as the other one, four times the amount of power. And so very interesting, but I'll be talking about what is known as baseline interferometry. And what does that mean? And I'll be relating it to the Nazca lines. So very interesting topic. And first of all, I want to mention this past week, wow, are things ever crazy in outer space? China and Russia have militarized outer space in anticipation of the United States. So while we were watching the little Mars rovers drive around on Mars and send back pictures of Mars, which there's a number of people, including myself, that wonder if those are really sending back pictures of Mars. And the reason is because this little rover seems to have a way of taking pictures of itself, and it also has a way of cleaning itself up on a regular basis, just spick and span, nice and clean, like it just went down to the corner car wash. So there's something a little funny there, and I'm just going to mention also this past, last week, January 3rd, China claimed that it landed on the far side of the moon. It's got this little buggy rolling around, just rolled out just like a Christmas present out of its box that landed on the far side of the moon and is traipsing around the moon taking pictures. Now, there's some funny things about the pictures. I'm just going to say that. There's some funny things, and I'm not going to go into detail. I don't want to start a conspiracy theory. But suffice it to say that I notice it. Other people may notice too. If somebody's going to raise these points, I'll let them do it. But okay. But back to the idea that the United States now, Shanahan, is the current Department of Defense director. He's adopted this, or they've adopted him. He was the vice president or the undersecretary of defense, and he was an ex-Boeing employee. Now the United States is faced with a big dilemma. And of course, Trump announced his Space Force, which was supposed to be, the original idea was that this would be an independent organization. But of course, I'm sure that all the military branches were jumping up and down saying, well, you know, if you're going to create another space, independent space force, that would cause a dilemma. So they, of course, the Air Force believes that it should be under them. Well, if they had had their act together over past decades, we would already have a space force, and there would not be a need to create a new one. But the Air Force is a very overbloated agency, and it cannot do effectively what it's already doing. So to try and bring this whole issue of space, now I talk extensively about developing military for outer space in my book, The Diamond Principle. The Diamond Principle, I make it very clear that outer space militarization is a bad idea. The reason it's a bad idea, well, number one, it's outlawed by every international treaty that's ever been signed in throughout history. And once the first major power, of which we have three, Russia, China, United States, the first time somebody raises the least little flag of militarization of outer space, the other ones will follow, and then it will be a matter of one-upsmanship. China being the nation that probably has the best ability to win this so-called race. It's a race in which there are no winners because it's like fighting invisible boogeymen. you know, as soon as you killed one, whoops, bum, three or four pop up over there. The China and Russia right now have what are known as hypersonic gliders. These are spacecraft that can go into outer space, and just to give you a little idea here, anything in low Earth orbit is moving at a bit over 17,000 miles per hour. That means that it goes around the Earth in about an hour and a half is about the amount of time it takes for that thing to go all the way around the Earth. Now, if you put a bunch of these up there, you could have them raining out of the sky into a given point on Earth's surface on a moment's notice. And this was the ban that was put in place back in the 1960s when Russia came out with what is known as MERV, M-E-R-V, multiple reentry vehicles. And the idea of a multiple reentry vehicle is that they're already in orbit around the Earth. And, of course, the implication is nuclear weapons, that they could come raining down on a given point in a matter of minutes. And there's no defense for this. So they were outlawed. The idea of using space as an instantaneous launch platform for nuclear weapons or even conventional weapons was outlawed. And now both China and Russia have MERV-type reentry vehicles, but they're basically gliders, which means the MERVs, the thing about the MERVs is they were basically nuclear warheads. So when they came in like a shotgun, they would spread apart, and the idea being that you could not shoot them all down, no matter what kind of laser weapon or defensive weapon or anti-ballistic missiles, whatever your mode of defense would be. There would be no way to shoot them down, and some of them would get through, you know, of these hundreds of them, you know, tens or dozens would get through and cause ultimate destruction. But the issue with the gliders, the hypersonic gliders, is that they can be redirected once they're in the atmosphere. They can fly in, they can glide, they can turn, they can go backwards if necessary, and they will... and they can be redirected to any location at all. China also has kinetic energy weapons. It's basically like a shotgun in space. You let go of it at 17,000 miles an hour at orbital speed, a quantity of basically metal shrapnel, and basically there's no satellite ever made or that could be made that would be able to defend against this, because first of all, you're not certain what side this is coming from, and small, sharp pieces, jagged pieces, or just shrapnel-like nuts or bolts coming at that speed would just rip anything to shreds. And so these are very simple weapons that cannot be used for defense. Now, let me just make something clear. The United States' Achilles heel is technology. The entire military operation from, you know, cruise missiles to going to the bathroom required GPS. And so logistics, everything requires, you know, placement and location and electronically monitored, especially location and movement. So coordination on the battlefield, everything is dependent upon GPS and planning. So if all of a sudden your GPS system is down, you're in a world of hurt. You're not going to be able to coordinate your forces, and forces that are not coordinated have a real problem. So basically what's going on is with very simple offensive weapons, very simple, nothing technical, nothing high-tech. And all of our satellites also are completely visible for the type of satellites for GPS, etc. They're really, with the signaling that has to go on, everybody knows exactly where these things are. So the United States is extremely vulnerable, but more so, there's no planning going on. There has never been any real good planning for outer space. And so you really, there's an old expression, don't take a knife to a gunfight. And while we were, as I said, while we were sitting around watching the Mars rovers, these little NASA Tinker Toys running around Mars and allegedly sending pictures back from Mars, thinking were that really advanced, the Chinese and the Russians were actually building things. And they're very efficient. Their industrial complex, their military-industrial complex, combined is a fraction of what we have in the United States. Shanahan, the Department of Defense director at this point, who will be replaced, I assume, with somebody that actually has some wherewithal, some ability to run the Department of Defense, he you know, being an ex-Boeing employee, now I read some dialogue on him, and so what they're worried is that he's not going to be effective because everybody's going to be looking at his every move. Oh, is he doing this just to kick back money to Boeing or the other aerospace industries? And by the way, he, as associate assistant director of the Department of Defense, he was in charge of Trump's new Space Force effort. And so there again, they need somebody in that position that really has a handle on what's going on. Now, in my book, The Diamond Principle, I make an analogy. I talk about Rome and the two-dimensional military strategy. If you take Rome as a great example, or any of Xerxes, the Byzantine Empire, Alexander the Great, I don't care who you look at throughout history, they were dealing with a two-dimensional playing field. So in other words, the surface of the earth can be viewed as a two-dimensional surface on a three-dimensional sphere. But basically, when you're sending out land armies, which was the case, the first time we really had aerial combat was in World War II. There was a smittance of it in World War I, but World War I was, again, primarily big waves of land armies marching across Europe. Some bit of mechanization, but it really came down to foot soldiers and land armies. But you could take a look at any of these wars, two-dimensional surfaces, that the farther you expand out, the more difficult it becomes to coordinate and to understand really what's going on there. Finally, the Roman armies got up into the Black Forest, and they were defeated by local, basically indigenous tribes, because the Romans would march off into these wooded areas or bogs or places like that. And the same thing happened with the British when they were hurt. When the British were trying to stabilize the 13 colonies, somebody in England was drawing a line on a map, march here, and so they were marching through swamps and forests, it was difficult to coordinate somebody drawing lines on a map in England that had no idea what was going on the ground and over here in the New World. But going back to the Romans, as they went out in two dimensions, they got thinner and thinner. The problem is, as I explained in the Diamond Principle book, is that the wealth, the booty, the robbing of the local populations kept flowing back into Rome. So the congressmen or the senators, as they were called back there in Rome, didn't see any change. They were still fat and happy. The Roman armies were still coming back with tales of conquered lands, and nobody really paid any attention until finally reality struck that the Roman Empire was collapsing under its own weight. And, of course, this was due to militarism, the collapse of society, the collapse of the family, and many other things that went along with the demise of the Roman Empire. But the point about going out in three dimensions is that now you, like say you want to put a base on the moon, okay, once again, you can imagine this as a two-dimensional surface, but the deployment of military equipment in three dimensions, if you're down on the surface of the moon, you're very vulnerable because you're locked down into a position. It's very difficult to move. The more you accumulate there, the more vulnerable you become, and the easier it is for somebody to come in from some obtuse angle out from outer space and destroy everything that you've built. But the real problem with outer space militarization is that if you, like the United States has done, put a lot of effort into GPS, into electronics, into high tech, that becomes very vulnerable. But you've spent your resources on very limited capabilities and infrastructure. You have spent a tremendous amount of resources putting up limited infrastructure that can be taken out on a moment's notice and on which you are vitally dependent. And so let's imagine now this grows. All of a sudden, we're starting to get out beyond Mars and Jupiter and into the bigger solar system. The three dimensions is exactly that. Putting your resources out into three-dimensional space is much more difficult and costly than putting your resources into two-dimensional space. Delivering military might in three-dimensional space is very difficult. So let's imagine there's a country with insight that has read my book, The Diamond Principle, and understands that if you forget about all the military stuff and building reinforcements and armament and defenses in the near-Earth region, then all of a sudden you can go much farther, much faster, and the people who are concentrating on investment in militarism are going to be bogged down under their own weight. And so if you really wanted to get into space with, as they say, one of the military expressions, the fustest with the mustest, the first with the most, then you get there without military, basically without military cover. And you can build spacecraft. Now, the other problem with NASA and military in general is they build something, one or two of them. NASA builds two Voyager spacecraft. They build one SOHO satellite. They build, one IRIS satellite to look at the microwave background radiation. They build one or two. They build two Mars rovers and send them up there and then let them run for 10 years. And we're all supposed to be amazed. Well, this is garbage. They should have, it's like anything mass-produced. You can mass-produce, once you produce two objects or satellites or experimental packages, you can produce hundreds of them for very little cost. It's those first couple that are costly. So if you stop after making one or two, your cost per unit of experimental package or militaristic capability is enormous, and you have very little capability. So all in all, the United States model of going into outer space is essentially flawed. And anybody who gets into the Department of Defense, if they do their, somebody was kidding me, I was talking about this with a friend before the show, and I was saying that Shanahan is not going to succeed. He's not going to succeed because he's basically strapped with this albatross of military-industrial complex around his neck in trying to make a space force. And the person responded and said, no, he's doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing. He is succeeding at creating a very expensive space force capability that's going to cost lots of money. And then he referred to Cheney at the beginning or right after the 9/11 events. And the comment was that this is going to take a long time and a lot of money. And so that is basically the United States, the U.S. way, the American way, when it comes into the Department of Defense. build up a lot of money, send it off to the aerospace corporations, and let them do their work. Let all of the stockholders and the stakeholders, as they're called, not just stockholders, but stakeholders, the people in the military-industrial complex, make all of this money, and there's really no scientific or engineering studies to tell you that what you're paying for is actually has any value. And so right now, the United States is so far behind in the space efforts, it's just so absolutely far behind. And this is the funny part. It's not funny, but it's ridiculous, that the United States, the discussion is, where will this new space force be placed? I mean, they can't even figure out where it should be in the structure of the Department of Defense. Should it be under the Air Force? Should it be independent? Should NASA have something to do with it? You know, all of these questions, it's going to take them 2 years to figure out where this thing should even be placed. And in 2 years, China and Russia are going to be light years ahead of us in terms of developing actual space weaponry. So the point here is, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, is that the United States is in a horrifically poor position. And the whole issue of outer space, Space Force, the Air Force, which is going to be, that would be a terrible place to put the Space Force, but it appears that that's where it's going to go because of political pressure, because the Air Force wants its piece of the pie. It wants its, you know, responsibility, so to speak, because if there were a Space Force, that would be viewed by anybody in the Air Force as minimizing their role in things that happen above the ground. 10 feet above the ground is the dominion of the Air Force, and to limit them to below 60 miles up would be against what the Air Force considers their domain. And they've also basically, by default, de facto, been the force that deals with outer space, although, once again, they really have not done anything in that region. They've been concentrating on tactical fighter planes and other forms of air combat that are closer to the ground. So, anyway, the end result is the Air Force would be a terrible place to put this Space Force, but that appears to be what Shanahan is going to do. And, of course, all of the contacts, you know, it all comes back to the same thing. The aerospace corporations already have all of their people in the military and in these positions in the Air Force. And if there was a new Space Force, they would have to develop this all over again, and they don't want to do this. So it all comes back to who controls the money, who controls the development. It's not about defense. It's not about protecting you. It's about who gets the money. So, but the end result is that they can't even figure out where to put this, let alone what kind of defense products they should be developing to give us sound defense. And when it comes to outer space, the very simplest weapons are the most effective. So you can develop all of the GPS and the, you know, the coordination and the advanced software, you know, etc. The AI intelligent interfaces, you can develop all of this you want, but it'll all be shattered in a New York second if a country like China or the USSR, the Russia, whatever you call it now, takes and wipes out our satellite fleet. This is a very, very vulnerable position to be in. And what it turns out is that maybe there should be just a moratorium on space militarization, which actually there already is. These have been in place for a very long period of time, and countries are just blatantly ignoring them. So we're in a very bad position. We're not in a position to take a knife to a gunfight, and really, it's not even, that's not a very good analogy anymore, because the knives that we have, the weapons that we have, basically could be defeated by butter knives, in a sense. If you took butter knives up and let them loose at orbital speed, they would take care of any satellite in existence. So these are not sophisticated weapons. You might consider them offensive weapons, but in a sense, they could be considered defensive weapons by destroying our line of communication, thusly defending them against any types of attacks that were coordinated because of our advanced technologies. In the Syrian war, there was an episode where the United States sent in a whole series of drones, and basically Russia took them out in a New York second. There was basically the drones really did not make it to their targets. These are American drones. Okay, well, anyway, enough of that, but all I can tell you is that the military in Washington, D.C. is floundering, and Trump, of course, is bogged down with this bureaucracy that's been built up since World War II. It's going to be a big mess, and I can guarantee you, I can smell the writing on the wall that this new Space Force will be put under the Air Force, and it's just going to be hogs to the trough. Money and really no results. 10-year programs, big, humongous, anti-ballistic this, gliders or hypersonic glider, you know, technology in development. And Reagan proved one thing, is the thing he proved was that Star Wars type programs are expensive and they will break you. That's what broke the Soviet Union. That's what's going to break the United States, and with little defensive capability as a result. Okay. On just a couple other issues, that's probably the biggest Achilles heel that the United States faces today. Two other ones, the Canary Islands. This is an issue that nobody wants to touch with a 10-foot pole. The capability of a landslide in the Canary Islands if there's a volcanic eruption, Canary Islands being volcanically very active, and then the tsunami that would come across the ocean between 5 to 8 or 9 hours or 10 hours, depending on where you are in the United States. I think it's about 8 hours from the Canary Islands to Miami, probably 5 hours across to Nova Scotia, and the eastern seaboard, down to Washington, D.C., with very little warning, massive tidal wave coming inland. And basically, it would destroy, you know, probably one-third of the United States population in a matter of hours. You could not get in your car, say you had a warning exactly when the landslide might occur over in the Canary Islands. And say you had a warning, the warning went out on the radio. Any place along that eastern seaboard, you would be hard-pressed to drive in the 5 or 6 or 10 hours. You would be hard-pressed to get out of the way of that tsunami. So that's a major issue that the United States now, is there a cure? And it turns out that there is. You could go with underground vehicles and slowly make preparations and remove that terrain, causing many, many landslides, thousands of mini landslides, and this would all have to be very well coordinated. But if you could get that land that would normally slide off in one big piece to slide off in thousands and thousands of little episodes, you could literally save the eastern seaboard of the United States from major catastrophe. But, of course, nobody's talking about that. All of our lofty scientists are running around trying to talk about global warming, that maybe in 30 years, 0.1 degree temperature, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. We have immediate needs, And the next issue is the Yellowstone volcano. That it is, if that baby goes off with the lake that is there, that lake turns into steam, you can kiss about one-third of the United States goodbye. All of the agricultural production in that area, it would be a major disaster as far east as Minnesota or Wisconsin, having an ash cloud, and that can be prevented also by simply draining the lake at Yellowstone. Drain it out the southeast corridor. I have that marked out on my webpage. We've known about this for a very long time. Very easy to alleviate the possibility. And what does NASA come along? They go, oh, we want to drill a hole into and pump water down into the magma. Exactly the opposite thing of what you should be doing. And, of course, they learned in the recent Hawaiian volcanoes that you cannot pump water down into a magma sheet. It's going to turn into steam, and there is speculation. I don't know if I have my own opinion about this. I don't really believe this is a major cause of the volcanoes in Hawaii, but they had the geothermal plants there, pumping water down into the ground to create steam, and then that steam being harvested to create electricity. What a bad idea. And interestingly enough, that generating station was consumed in the volcanic flows that it created. And as a result, they shut down. And this is, by the way, Harry Reid, our money-groping senator from down there in the American Southwest, Nevada. What a bunch of idiots. That was his company. But you cannot pump water down into a volcano. You have to get the water at the lake of Yellowstone Lake. That water has to be drained out of there, and it would go down the southeast corridor there. I show how to do it on my webpage. And then the most that would happen at Yellowstone would be a minor flow, a lava flow. And the three times in history when the Yellowstone caldera really blew, all three incidents were accompanied by a lake in the caldera. So that's what happens. A fissure breaks, the water starts to seep down in, it hits the magma. It causes the first wave of explosions wherein the lake completely drops down into the magma, turns to steam, and that's where the mega volcano comes from, is from that lake water converting into steam. So that can be averted. The Canary Islands issue can be averted, and the space, the problem we have with outer space can be averted with proper knowledge and planning. Okay, so my main science topic tonight, I want to talk about baseline interferometry and what is that. Okay, well, essentially, let's take a look at your eyes. Your eyes are a great example, or your ears also. Now, your eyes react to light stimulation, and they're set apart. They're set apart for a reason, because you get a triangulation. Your brain has learned how to triangulate and estimate distances so that if you see an object on the table over there, if you have one eye closed, well, you know pretty much how far away something is on a table. But if you only have one eye, you cannot measure distances. Triangulation is not a viable option for measuring distances. And like I say, there's something on your desk. Well, if you have just one eye open, then just from experience, you know about how far away that is. So anyway, the idea of separated sensors, your ears are the same. So if you get some sound in one ear and the same source of sound, you get sound in the other ear. By balancing those out, your brain has learned how to make an estimate. It was a little louder in this ear, not so loud in this ear, so it's over here on this side. And you can estimate location by sound because you have two ears. If you only have one ear, then you cannot make an estimate of distance or location, because only one ear is receiving the sound. So the same principle applies to telescopes. And you'll find binoculars, for example, or binocular telescopes. Or the same holds true of radio telescopes, where they're receiving radio signals from outer space. Now, I've used interferometers before, and just a quick mention, I'll get back to this topic before the end of the show. When I wrote my paper on the radio antenna complex at Nazca, Peru, when I discovered that those figures, the monkeys and the whales and the parrots and the other figures there, are actually radio antennas to receive and transmit, but they are also, because of their separation, they are an interferometer. They are capable of receiving signals and determining direction. Okay, so anyway, now let's imagine two radio telescopes. They're discs, parabolic discs, and they receive radio signals. The dish is to focus them up to what is called a power head, or the head end amplifier, and the radio signals are received and amplified and then measured and run through electronics, etc. But just like your ears or your eyes that are capable of determining direction, the farther apart the two antennas, the two dish antennas, the farther apart they are, the better triangulation, the better resolution you get. And so there's somewhat of a rule of thumb that let's take a look out. And by the way, if you want to take a look at this, pictures of these interferometers and further discussion of interferometers, my Nazca Lines paper goes into a very good discussion on astronomical interferometers. The whole concept of an interferometer is that the antennas are separated, they're looking at the same subject area, and they're seeing a little bit different picture, and when you put those two pictures together, you basically get a stereo image. The rule of thumb also is that the bigger your antenna, the more detail you get. In other words, the finer detail you can measure. But with an interferometer, let's imagine we're going to make bigger and bigger radio telescopes on planet Earth and look out into the heavens, etc. Okay, so the bigger you make it, due to the principles of optics and electromagnetic theory, the bigger you make your dish, the more resolution you get in the final image you get, the radio image that you are able to detect. But in an interferometer, say you take two antennas and you put them a distance apart that is equivalent to a great big antenna. In other words, the diameter of a great big antenna, you put a small antenna at one edge and a small antenna at the other edge, you can get not as much collecting surface area. You don't get as much surface area for collection of the signal. But what you do get is the resolution. So if you're able to pick up enough signal and put two antennas a distance apart, then you can get the resolution without building this gigantic antenna. Now, the idea with what the Russians are doing, they're using the space-based radio telescope as one of the eyes, so to speak, and then another one on Earth as the other eye. And by putting the space-based telescope in a special orbit that goes around the moon, and actually quite a bit farther than the moon, they can get a baseline. In other words, this is the distance between the eyes, so to speak, the distance between the antennas, of 1.5 million miles. So this is a huge baseline interferometer antenna. And it allows tremendous resolution looking out into the universe. And, of course, the problem is, once they get all the data, how is it going to be interpreted? Is this going to be another Big Bang support at all costs, interpret the data only in terms of Big Bang and general relativity, which, by the way, are totally both bogus theories. General relativity has no experimental foundation. I've exposed that in my paid cast, where I show that the Eddington experiment, which supposedly proved general relativity, he cherry-picked the data. Eddington cherry-picked the data. He only put in his report the data points that he liked, that met with the what general relativity predicted, and all the other data points he threw out, which did not corroborate general relativity. And so nobody has ever duplicated that. So it's been based on that feeble cherry-picked data that general relativity has gone for all of these decades, and without any proof, without any second or third experiments that would somehow verify Eddington's experiment. And as I pointed out, I go into this entire discussion, if you want a good discussion of this, my downloadable DVD on my webpage dealing with it's the first session, it's called DVD number 4, it's downloadable DVD, where I talk about cosmology and that specific topic. I go into a long discussion of the Eddington experiment, and I show the cherry-picked data and prove that basically general relativity has no basis. So anyway, my point is that I hope that the Russians are going to do real science with this equipment and not just cater to the Big Bang general relativity crowd that now dominates the Western world science. I hope the Russians, just from working with the Russians, they're a very different breed of scientists. They don't cater to baloney, and the United States, the news media, and this, primarily the science news media, has done a horrific job of covering science. They have just, the news media has just given carte blanche to anything that the standard scientific community brings up and gives to them. They're just they're science repeaters. They're not science reporters, and certainly not investigative journalists. At any rate, let's go back to the main idea here, that an interferometer is basically an array. It could be as few as two, but an array of telescopes or optical devices. The other thing about the interferometer is that because they are apart, also they are at different distances from the viewing object, the object being viewed. And therefore, they are a number of wavelengths distance, different in distance from the object. And that difference can be used also to fine-tune and focus in on specific objects. So it's, anyway, without going into a lot of specific detail, the interferometers are basically arrays of antenna. Now, there's one out in the American Southwest. It's called the VLA, the Very Large Array of Antennas. And I have a picture of this also in my white paper on the Nazca Lines. But it's an array typically in the shape of a Y. And these radio antennas are on railroad, basically railroad tracks. So they can be moved around. But basically the idea is that you put the antennas in the form of a Y, and then the overall antenna size is equivalent to a disk that would encompass that entire area. And once again, you don't have to build a radio antenna that's, say, 2 miles across. You just have to build a dozen or two dozen small antennas that fill up that area, that extend across the area. And so then you don't have to build giant radio telescopes. You just have to build many small ones and put them in an array. And of course, they have to be finely tuned so that they are all looking at the same object, etc. And that gives you a radio telescope that is much bigger than the actual radio telescope that you produced. Now, going back to the Nazca lines, if you haven't seen my paper on the Nazca lines, it's available on the webpage. Just go to jmccsci.com to go to the secure web ordering page. Scroll down to the books, the CD, DVDs, etc. And it's one of the available items there. The entire issue here is when I was in Peru a couple years ago, I basically went to the Nazca Line just because it was a tourist attraction, never imagining that by being there at the site, I would actually discover what the use of these was, these lines were what it was, and also how they were powered. They were powered with atmospheric electricity, and all of the lines come up to a single location on man-made hills, and that's another very important issue, is because out in the middle of the Nazca Plains, there are no hills. It is flat, and it's not perfectly flat. It's somewhat undulating, and you can see that in the photography that I included in the Nazca Lines paper. But out in those plains, miles and miles apart, are fractal antennas in the form of monkeys and birds and whales and spiders and other animals that really are not from that local environment. The whales are from the ocean many, many miles away, 100 miles away. And really, the Peruvians that we know about, the Incas, these were, by the way, made by, from our understanding, by pre-Inca civilizations. They really, really, really don't know who built the Nazca Lines. But it's very clear that not only did they clear out these regions to make fractal antennas, but they took the material and built it into mounds where clearly at one point in history there was atmospheric electricity collecting devices there. The other thing about the antennas is they could be switched on and off. So that would be like playing a grand piano, in a sense, very characteristic overtones, etc., from each one of these radio antennas. So without going into a lot of detail, the lines at Nazca, Peru, are probably the largest array of fractal interferometry antennas in ever in existence. The complexity of the site is beyond comparison. So when you understand what whoever built those was very savvy, very understanding of antennas, and a fractal antenna is much more powerful than a full-size antenna. The whole idea of a fractal antenna is you break an antenna down into many small pieces. And additionally, there are dipole antennas, which are just straight line antennas, which extend over many, many, many kilometers distance. And these are crisscrossed to give you complex dipole antennas, single straight line antennas with varying frequencies. And when they cross, that gives you, once again, another set of frequencies and another capability of transmitting information. So the point is that, going back to the Russians are putting up a single satellite, a single parabolic satellite, very lightweight, with its the structure is tubular and like a matrix that holds up the panels for the radio telescope. And then all of this is very lightweight material. But once it gets out into outer space, it'll be there are really no stresses. So it'll be out at some point in time 1.5 million miles from Earth, giving us 1.5 million mile baseline interferometer. So this will be by far the most powerful radio telescope ever built by man, modern man, that is, notwithstanding the structures at Nazca. But the current model of the astronomical radio telescope from Russia is actually up and running and has been for probably well over a decade now. I should also mention that unlike the Nazca lines, the telescope that Russia is putting up is not designed to transmit. The Nazca lines were designed to receive and transmit, and that's what makes them very special, because back in the distant past, who knows, 10,000 years ago, we don't really know who built them or when or how they built them. It looked like a lot of hand labor, but if you were to, say, do a custom analysis of time to build just one of the Nazca lines, interferometer fractal antennas, it would take just innumerable man hours, probably months and months and months to build a single one of them. And there are many of them out there. What they did basically is, if you've ever been at the Nazca Plains, it's a covering of white limestone. The entire plains are covered with white limestone, and on top of that are many small rocks. It's just covered about every 3 to 4 inches is a rock, and these rocks are reddish in color. I have pictures of them in my white paper on the Nazca lines. They are kind of a reddish color, and they're full of iron, very high iron content rocks, little small ones, smaller than the palm of your hand typically. And the entire plain is covered with those. So what the ancients did is they simply moved these rocks in patterns and built up, they took the rocks and built little kind of like walls along the edge of a trough. Some of the troughs are as little as a few feet, and some of them are as wide as a meter or more wide. But it's basically a little trough. So then from a distance, what you see is, with those rocks removed, you see the basically the troughs, and in the form of animals. Now, to survey this area would be rather difficult because it's not perfectly flat. It's undulating. And so the real reasonable way that these figures were made was from the air projected on the ground. And the other thing is very interesting is that if you walk, if you so much as make a footprint out there on the Nazca Plains, and it's going there is prohibited, is absolutely prohibited. And when I was there, there was a guard actually sitting there in his car and making sure you did not go off into the plain area, because a single footprint could damage the area forever, because there's no rain, there's no erosion there, and they basically would be, a lot of foot traffic would ruin the area. And the point being is that when these were built, the builders walked only along the lines. They only stayed with their feet in the troughs, and then moved the rocks aside, and then dug out just a little bit and carried that dirt back to the mounds, where they stored that dirt and made the mounds and created the elevation areas where the atmospheric electricity was then generated. It was received from the atmosphere. And so, but there's nothing left there, and you would not expect anything really to be left there if it were made of metal. Just the salt air, the proximity to the ocean would have, over thousands and thousands of years, would have completely obliterated any semblance of materials that would have been used to build a tower, a metal tower, than to collect atmospheric electricity. So, all very interesting. The Nazca lines, finding the solution to those was probably one of my great discoveries of my lifetime, because I've been at archaeological sites. I've observed at the Mayan, Incas, and the Aztec sites. I've been on sites where the digs were actually being excavated while I was there. But the discovery at Nazca was unexpected. And really, after tens of thousands of scientists have visited that site, after there were scientists who lived there, some spent their entire careers there studying those lines and never came up with the correct solution that I found was that they were built to be communications, telecommunications, fractal antennas. Fractal antennas are something that we've only known about in modern times. Remember the flip phones back in the mid-2000s? You had a flip phone, and then you pulled out a little antenna, that dipole antenna. Okay, well, after fractal antennas became understood in Western antenna design, that was only about 10 years ago. And here the ancients were building massive fractal antennas 10,000 years ago, and we don't know who did this. But clearly they were very akin to telescope design. So back to the discussion of the Russians. The Russians are putting up a radio telescope with a long baseline interferometer to study activity in outer space. So I hope I get to talk to some of these people and hopefully influence how that data is interpreted and the way it's actually presented to the public. As you possibly know, I've been on Russian television a number of times and potentially will be there again in the future. I'm told that I'm one of the favorite scientists, the visiting scientists. The Russian people love my commentary television. I've been on Japanese television. I have a full DVD about that on my sales page. It's What the Japanese Want to Know About Planet X. And lastly, and most importantly, I have a new release coming out. It'll be released in about a month. It's up for pre-sale on my sales page, and I'm encouraging people to join my paid cast. So what I'm doing is reviewing my books, and right now I'm currently reviewing Calculate Primes. That's the current book for January 2019. Very important book, along with my book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. So go to my webpage, click on the secure web ordering page, and look for the different deals for complete book sets, water filters where you get the books free, etc. And join the paid cast. I'm encouraging everybody to join the paid cast. Very important information on a weekly basis, only $3.95 per month, and it very much helps me, and it very much helps get the information to you, to the public. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. I also want to stress the importance of reading my books and listening to the CDs, DVDs, etc. before you listen to the paid casts. Very important, because I expand on these materials in the paid cast. So I encourage, once again, everybody, go to my webpage, join the paid cast. It's only $3.95 a month. You'll be very glad you did. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.